We're delighted to welcome with us today on this rainy, cloudy day, Monroe High School students. Would you please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. Priya, students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by this court and the Wisconsin State Bar. Under this program, we invite students from around the state to come and listen to oral arguments. If the invitation is accepted, then the students will be sent the briefs of the case. They may engage in activities related to the case. They come to court, and then they meet with a justice to discuss the procedures of the court, not the substantive law. And the meeting occurs after the second case that we will hear today. Anyone who wishes to may join the students with the justice during lunch hour. It is not limited, and that includes counsel. Let me introduce the court to all of you. On the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And Justice Bradley will be talking with you this afternoon after the second case. To her right is Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I'll call our first case, 078-P-72-CR, State versus Grady. Representing Mr. Grady is Carl Chesser. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Justices. I'm Attorney Carl Chesser, and I represent the defendant, Marshawn Grady. And I'm pleased to have this opportunity to once again argue a case before this court. On May 15, 2005, Alan Keith Jemison was murdered. After a jury trial, my client, Marshawn Grady, was convicted of first-degree intentional homicide. And I take umbrage with that result. In its case in chief, the state was permitted to present the jury with two statements made by Grady to the police while he was in custody. And I believe that the admissibility of these two statements were in violation of Grady's Fifth Amendment constitutional rights. Grady had assisted the police in arresting and locating the suspect, Marcus Ward. Grady, upon the police's request, Grady voluntarily went down to the police station to continue to help assist him. He was repeatedly told that he was not under arrest. He was never handcuffed. He accompanied the police down to the police station. He got there about 7:30, and he was there to assist the detectives. At about 8:16 that evening, Detective Corbett came into the interrogation room where Grady was and gave him his Miranda rights. Even though Grady was not under arrest or he was not in custody, and it's undisputed that Grady at this point in time, it was a non-custodial interview. At about 10:45 that evening, Grady was under the impression that the police were making arrangements to take him back home. Instead, they came into the interrogation room. They told him that Ward had implicated him in the homicide. They told him that he was under arrest. They placed him in custody, ordered him to remove his shoelaces, the drawstring from his hoodie. They did not give him his Miranda rights after they arrested him and placed him in custody. But they did continue to question him now about the homicide as a suspect, and they continued that for about 7 hours. I believe that this first statement that Grady gave the police should not have been admitted in the state's case in chief. And we do not have to look any further than the Miranda case to arrive at that conclusion. There was no dispute that Detective Colbert initially gave Grady his Miranda rights and that it was in a non-custodial setting. After he was placed under arrest and in a custodial interrogation, however, he was not given his Miranda rights.
Mr. Cheshire, may I just ask a point of clarification? Sometimes when I would do hearings on waiver of Miranda rights and whether there was a violation of Miranda, there would be a form that law enforcement would give the person being interviewed, and they would fill it out that they understood their rights and that they were waiving their rights and that they would sign off on that form. Is that part of the record here at all, a form like that?
And frankly, I do not recall that. Yeah, usually it's a pedigree form that prefaces that also. And I do not recall that, but recall testimony of the detectives reading off of their Miranda cards his rights.
That's all I saw, and I just wondered if that extra fact was in the record somewhere, and I just didn't see it. Thank you.
Can I follow through with that also?
Sure.
After he was given his Miranda rights, apparently he continued with the questions and answers. Was he asked at all whether or not he understood those rights?
Are you talking in the non-custodial setting?
Right.
I believe that Detective Corbett testified that Grady indicated that he did understand his rights.
Okay, how about the waiver issue? Did he then say, you know, he was waiving or giving up those rights, or is that just implied by the fact that he continued to speak to the officers and didn't request counsel?
Well, I know that he continued to talk to the detectives. I don't recall specifically if he said that he waived his rights. I guess part of my argument would be that he wasn't in custody and there wouldn't be really any rights at that. He wasn't under arrest. There's no rights for him to waive at that time.
Did the officer testify in that regard at all, beyond saying that he said he understood the rights?
I don't recall specifically, Your Honor. I don't want to misrepresent. I don't recall the detective saying that he specifically waived. I believe he said that he understood him and that they continued talking.
All right, thank you.
Counsel, doesn't the right against self-incrimination exist whether or not an individual is in custody? And so therefore, why is it an important distinction at the moment of custody? It appears to me that the bright line rule you're proposing is that at the moment of custody, that the Miranda warnings be given if there's going to be interrogation. Does that about sum it up?
First of all, the bright line that I'm proposing, actually, when I look at it, that's Miranda. That's really not me.
Well, the interpretation you are urging upon this court, which is heretofore unknown in case law, as far as I know, is that there be an express bright line rule along those lines. Yes.
And in response, yes.
Okay.
And in response, if the person is not in custody, that statement can be admitted. I think the issue is whether the statement should be admitted or not. If the person is not in custody and he gives a statement against his interest, that's admissible. That can be admitted, whether he's given his Miranda rights or not. I think the issue is whether or not a statement is admissible when he's given it in a custodial setting and he's not given his rights.
All right, and so the critical moment in your analysis is when?
Is when he is placed in custody, when that custodial interrogation begins.
And so if he's given the Miranda warnings 5 minutes before that moment in time, and he indicates he understands them, and then by his actions acquiesces or indicates that he wants to waive his right, if the moment of custody takes place 5 minutes after that, under that analysis, anything said after that would be inadmissible unless a new Miranda warning was given. True?
And I believe that's what Miranda says. Yes.
Okay.
Now, he was given one full Miranda warning when he was in the police station voluntarily and not in custody, right?
Yeah. He was given his Miranda rights twice.
And then, before they got the second statement on the May 17th night, they gave him another Miranda warning.
Correct.
Right? Okay. And in between, they may or may not have shown him a card.
And what?
A Miranda card.
Yeah,
Well, the judge, there was testimony that they might have, but there was no finding about that. Okay.
The Court of Appeals and the state has put forth essentially a totality of the circumstances argument to show that Grady was aware of his Miranda rights and therefore the statement should be admissible. I believe if we follow that line of reasoning, we're actually going to put the law back 40 years to pre-Miranda. The reason I say that is Justice Clark, in the Miranda decision, argued against Miranda holding and in favor of the existing totality of circumstances rule, including the failure to give the necessary warnings to show that a confession was voluntary. And Miranda holding abrogated that totality of circumstances rule. The Miranda court held that at the outset of a custodial interrogation, a person must be given his warnings in clear and unequivocal terms. And an absolute prerequisite is necessary to overcome the inherent pressures of a custodial interrogation. And the court went on and said that the Fifth Amendment privilege is so fundamental to our system of constitutional rule, and that the giving of adequate warnings is so simple, the court stated, we will not pause to inquire in individual cases whether the defendant was aware of his rights without a warning being given. And the court went on and said, we're trying to assess a defendant's knowledge based on their age, education, or prior contacts is basically just speculation, but a warning would be a fair cut fact.
Counselor, how does your argument fit within the lead opinion of Hambly, where we said being in custody is not sufficient, you must be in custody and know that custodial interrogation is imminent?
I guess I think it's in concert with what I'm asking
okay.
The court today.
All right.
Because I believe that, I think that the person should also be aware they're in custody. I think we have both the subjective and objective standards when we look at that.
Well, I'm looking beyond just custody. I'm looking at whether there was a custodial interrogation that would be imminent. How does your rule fit with that?
Okay. I think that Miranda is saying that we have cases there where it came to fog. I think Elstad, for instance, is similar to that. But I think particularly when you have a situation where the police is controlling the environment, they're controlling when the person is placed in custody, not in custody, if there's no gray area there, then I think it's very clear that once they're placed in custody, they have to be given their Miranda rights if they want that subsequent statement to be admissible.
I think that's fine. I understand your position. Thank you. In Hambly, the guy was in custody. Did not get a Miranda right. He claimed the right to counsel. The issue was whether it was anticipatory. In this case, he is not in custody.
Correct.
He gets a Miranda warning. It's too early. He's not in custody, and he's not under a custodial interrogation. He may be being asked questions, but not every question is interrogation. So he may not even be interrogated under Miranda. The issue that you have, as I see it, and you may see it differently, is if you get a Miranda warning too soon, he's not in custody. Is that a prophylactic to a confession? Right? He confessed here. He confessed after he was in custody. Right?
Yes.
Without a further warning. Right?
Correct.
So that you're arguing, if I understand your argument, that first confession is no good because the Miranda warning was too early and did not carry over after arrest.
Yes.
Well, I don't know if you had a chance to look at Lefebvre. Are you familiar with the text?
No, I'm not.
Well, Lefebvre on criminal procedure, section 6.8b, says, and it cites State v. Burgee, which is a Connecticut case. The defendant came to the station voluntarily. It's like your guy, right? And was given the warnings. In that one, he waived his rights at about 4:30 p.m. when he was neither a suspect nor in custody. And he claimed that it was insufficient when he made a statement at 7 p.m. That's about 2.5 hours. That's about the same time that your client made a confession, right?
Well, was placed in custody. I'm not sure exactly.
And he was a suspect in custody at the time that he confessed at 7. The court acknowledged that pre-custodial warnings may fail to provide the necessary protection if the overall situation becomes significantly more coercive as a result of a changed custodial status. So they're looking at the total happenings to see if it's coercive, and that the Miranda warnings are therefore not prophylactic anymore. But the court concluded that that was not the case in the Berge case, as the defendant was continuously in the company of the police, was questioned on the same subject by the same officers throughout the time, and confessed within 4 hours of having been given the warnings. And that footnote cites numerous cases from around the country that say no renewal of warnings are needed where the warning is given before custody. Now, that seems to be the majority. I only found one case, which was a West Virginia case, that went the other way. What's the matter with those cases?
Your Honor, I believe that that's not what Miranda says. Your Honor,
so you think all these courts are wrong?
The short answer, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. You want a bright line rule.
And I think it makes sense in a lot of ways, Your Honor. But like Miranda said, that this warning is an absolute prerequisite to interrogation. They said no amount of circumstantial evidence that a person may be aware of this right will suffice to stand in its stead. I guess my concern is that regardless of what a person may know beforehand, I think that once they're placed in custody, once they're suddenly faced with charges, like in this case, all of a sudden, Grady knows that he may never get out of prison again. I could see where he might have been told his rights 3 hours ago. He might have been told he could have a right to an attorney. But until you're actually placed in that situation, facing that, I'm not sure that you would necessarily think that you would have that right that you could exercise it.
Well, you have a bright line rule. You're saying if you're not in custody, then any Miranda warning given is not a prophylactic for a confession made when in custody.
Correct.
Okay, suppose it was a half hour difference, or 20 minutes, or 10 minutes. Bright line work?
I don't see why we wouldn't want it to, why we wouldn't do it. Because again, as Miranda said, it would be so simple for them to give the warnings, to re-give the warnings. You know, the greatest case, I think, is a good example. I mean, they knew exactly when they were placing him in custody, and I don't see where there's going to be any problem or any harm with requiring the police then to give him his Miranda rights once again.
Isn't part of the problem with the custody thing that we determine it when a reasonable defendant would objectively believe he wasn't free to leave? But the argument you seem to be making is that when the police knew, forget what the defendant knew or didn't know, then they had to re-Mirandaize him. So I think we kind of have two different tests kind of going at each other. At least that's kind of what I'm hearing.
Actually, if I could address that, but sure. Also follow up with what Justice Abramson was asking, I think the concern would be is that you give the rights in a non-custodial setting and then you arrest the person, then in a sense what you're doing is you're allowing the police at that point in time to assess that defendant's awareness of their rights. And if the police decide, well, you must already be aware of the rights, we don't have to read them again, well, then you put the defendant in a situation where then they have to litigate the issue of his or her awareness of what's a fundamental constitutional right. And I believe that that's contrary to what Miranda's intent.
Counsel, it seems to me that in the law, there is oftentimes a benefit to have right-line rules. But if what you're asking for or focusing on is the defendant's knowledge of his rights, then isn't the bright-line rule kind of form over substance? If he had been advised of the rights 20 minutes before he was actually in custody?
It could be, but I don't see where it would make a difference. What you're saying is that, okay, let's say this was my criminal law professor, and he was given his rights 20 minutes ahead of time, and he's placed under arrest. Okay, I could understand reading his rights again might not have a whole lot of effect, might be form over function. But then, where is the harm? We haven't created any problems just because the person did know and was aware. But what we've done is we've taken out that additional element of criminal litigation.
Well, just following up on that argument, didn't your defendant have some experience in the criminal law field before he got picked
yes.
up on this?
Yes.
Wasn't he on probation
yes.
or parole or something? So he's felony? Was he involved in a previous felony?
I believe so, yes.
Did he get Miranda warnings then?
I don't know.
But he has some experience, right?
Yes.
So if you follow that argument about the law professor versus this guy, Mr. Grady, he has some experience. Do you want to get into that? Or do you want a bright line rule for
That's
everybody?
Just it. That's why I think that we have the bright line rule.
You have to put the law professor in too then. Bright line rule
yes.
is bright line rule.
Right. The law professor gets the rights also.
Okay. Well, it seems to be going a little bit far. I'm just teasing.
Well, I'd like to follow up on that. And I'd like to reference both the question that I had asked you earlier on in the hearing and that Justice Bradley just asked you before the Chief Justice's round of questioning. And I think during our last colloquy, you indicated to me that under the bright line rule that you are advancing on behalf of your client, that even if a warning had been given and understood 5 minutes prior to the moment of custody, the bright line rule would require a new Miranda warning at the moment of custody. True?
Yes.
All right. And so to put a little sharper focus on Justice Bradley's question in regard to form over substance, wouldn't that actually be fiction over substance? If the purpose of Miranda is to ensure that the individual is aware of these rights, and 5 minutes prior to the moment of custody, we are going to adopt the fiction that the person does not understand, why should that bright line rule be adopted? And I know you've answered now 3 or 4 times, what's the harm, ? As a rhetorical. But I'm asking you, what's the purpose?
Well, Miranda makes reference several times to the inherent interrogation pressures, the atmosphere of the custodial interrogation. And so I think that what my feeling is that once you put a person in custody, that's when you have the police pressure on top of them. And so at that point in time, I think, as Miranda says, giving the warnings then becomes a clear-cut fact. We don't, again, have to litigate how much, we're not going into the person's back history or whatever. If you give the warnings, you don't litigate the issue of whether or not the defendant actually was aware of his rights or not.
At what moment are you defining custody as taking place for the purpose of this bright line rule?
Well, okay. I think that when a person's under arrest, when they're not free to move.
Well, would it depend on the formal arrest, or could a Terry-type stop qualify?
I guess I would prefer to see the formal Terry stop starts getting a little funny because
person's not free to move. He's free to leave.
But if they did, if they do say, look, you're under arrest, and they want to talk to him, why not give him his rights?
Well, everybody agrees he was not in custody here. We're not debating whether he was in custody, are we? We're just not agreeing.
No.
Okay. You have a second confession. You've
Correct.
Got an orange light on. That means you've got about 4 minutes left.
Yes.
Three, 2 minutes left. So, what's your argument on the second confession, assuming that the first is not okay?
First of all, as I briefed, the Seibert case, I think, would be controlling. I would also point out that in Miranda, there were four cases that Miranda decided. One was Westover. In Westover, that's where the Kansas police interrogated the defendant without warnings, and the FBI then came in afterwards, did give him warnings, and they ruled that that confession to the FBI was not admissible. I think we have legal precedent here for that. I think in my brief, distinguish Elstad, and Elstad says if there's an inadvertent oversight, then we could perhaps excuse it. But in this case, I don't see where there's any inadvertent oversight. You know, the police knew exactly what they were doing. And, you know, the second statement, when basically Grady was sent back to the police prison processing service center about 7:30 in the morning. He was still there at 7:30 in the evening when Corbett brought him back to the interrogation room. So you have the same police officer in the same place and taking basically the same statement. And I think that all fits what the Seibert case stated, and I believe that that statement also should not be admitted.
Is there any, what is the evidence that the defendant would have acted differently if the warning had been given exactly as you wanted?
I guess I don't have an answer to that question. I don't know if it had occurred the way I would like to have seen it occur. I guess at least if he was going to give a confession, I would feel confident that he knew at that time that he didn't have to, that he could remain silent and he could request counsel. And I believe I'm out of time. So thank you very much.
Thank you. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Assistant Attorney General Warren Weinstein, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you. I'm Warren Weinstein, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin. I think Mr. Grady's proposed rule presents three or four serious problems with Miranda. First, it focuses not on whether or not a suspect is aware of the nature of the right to remain silent and is aware of the consequences of giving up that right, but rather on whether or not he is or is not actually in custody. Second of all, that seems to me to interject a subjective component into what's supposed to be an objective test. Thirdly, I think it is overformalistic to just automatically say, well, when you're in custody, at the moment you're in custody, regardless of what's gone on before, you must receive Miranda warnings. And fourth, it forces the police to make a judgment about when custody occurs, because a suspect doesn't need to know they're in custody, and even the police don't need to know that the person's in custody, because the court makes that objective determination subsequent to the actual interrogation. And so if the police guess wrong, then we have the same situation. If they guess he's in custody and they're wrong, then we have this Grady situation. If they guess he's not in custody and they're wrong, a perfectly good statement may be inadmissible. So I don't think this amounts to very good public policy. in addition to the fact that I don't think it's what Miranda requires. Miranda's focus is on whether or not a suspect is aware that they have the right to remain silent, and counsel is really kind of a prophylactic protection.
I think that underscores the whole purpose of my questioning of your opposing counsel in regard to the bright line rule he was proposing. If the bright line rule is being proposed, I think we need to know when it's going to kick in. And can you come up with a formulation as to when the bright line rule would kick in?
Well, I think based on Mr. Grady's brief, it would be when the police use the magic word arrest. But I'm not sure that coincides with actual custody for purposes of Miranda.
Interpreted by a series of longstanding cases.
That's right. Yep.
Miranda said, by custodial interrogation, we mean questioning initiated by law enforcement officers after a person has been taken into custody.
Right.
Or otherwise deprived of his freedom of action in any significant way. They don't use the word arrest.
No. And in fact, the cases that follow that are real clear that
right.
Arrest
so
is
something not
the key.
May be a little different. Custody may or may not be different than
right.
Arrest. And you don't even have to be in custody. You have to be deprived of freedom of action in any significant way.
That's
so
right.
That's really a little vague.
That's right. That's right. And in this case, the parties in the trial court did not contest that Mr. Grady was not in custody at the time the warnings were given.
And they don't contest that both confessions were voluntary.
That's right. As I read Mr. Grady's brief, he does not, not only does he not contest that the statements were voluntary, he never contests that he did not understand his rights.
Justice Crooks asked, was there a statement that I waive my rights with the Miranda warning, or was just silent?
I think that what the testimony was from the police officers was that Mr. Grady never asked for a lawyer and never refused to
answer. He didn't say I'm waiving all my rights.
Yeah, I don't recall any specific statement.
But he never said I'm asking for my rights.
That's, yes, that's my recollection.
Invoking my rights.
So does that mean that form doesn't exist? That you know?
It certainly doesn't exist for the first confession. I'm not sure whether or not he signed a form for the second one or not.
It's just not in the record.
You don't remember?
Yeah, there was no testimony that I recall referencing a signing of a waiver form. Now, there was testimony about the fact that Grady refused to sign a written statement the first time, but did sign it the second time. But I think that was the statement itself, not a waiver form.
I see this as a pretty creative argument. I think Mr. Cheshire makes a creative argument. More typically, the argument is the person should have been given their Miranda warnings because they really were in custody earlier, and they weren't given their Miranda warnings, so that statement needs to be suppressed on that basis. But he really wasn't free to leave. He was at the police station. He was given a statement and should have been given the warnings. And now it's almost backwards. We're saying because he was given his warnings, we're not having trouble with that statement. We want to suppress the subsequent statement because he wasn't given the warnings again.
That's how I understand the argument, yes.
Okay. It works both ways, then. You can attack the statements whether you get them or not?
Well, I don't think it should work both ways, but I think that's what you've got to decide here.
What is the present law on videotaping interrogations?
It wasn't at the time of this statement.
It wasn't?
No. There was no requirement of videotaping or audio recording or anything like that at the time of the statement.
Mr. Grady was not a suspect, but he was questioned. Would that interrogation have been videotaped under present law?
I don't think so, but I'd have to check to be sure. I must say that I don't remember the videotaping statute with that specificity right now. I think it only applies to custodial
questioning. Under
present law, let's say he was not being videotaped. He was, 19 years old when this happened?
I'm not sure of his age.
Let's suppose he was 17 years old.
Okay.
And he was being questioned when he was not a suspect. Any obligation to videotape that?
And juveniles are treated differently, and my inclination is that, yeah, that's right, but I'm not positive that that's correct. I am not up on the video.
Well, at 17, he would be considered an adult for criminal prosecution.
I'm sorry?
You said juveniles would be treated differently, but under Justice Prosser's hypothetical.
Oh, 17, you're right.
The individual is 17.
He wouldn't be a juvenile. That's correct.
Well, did all this questioning occur before Jarrell and before the statute?
Yes, I think so.
So that's not...
It's not an
issue of whether the statute was complied with.
Right.
I mean, I didn't check those dates, but I didn't see that.
I didn't either, because it was not raised, but I don't believe that the statute was in effect at the time of the question, of this questioning.
Let us suppose when a defendant is not a suspect, he is not being videotaped. Let's suppose that. Under present law, wouldn't there come a time that he becomes a suspect, or not a suspect, he becomes in custody? Wouldn't he have to go, wouldn't he have to be videotaped at that point?
I would think so. Yeah, I think they would have to begin videotaping at that point to comply with the statute. But I'm not sure that would mean that they would necessarily have to give Miranda. But if you use a totality of the circumstances analysis, which I think is the correct one, then certainly something like going from a non-videotaped interview to a videotaped interview would certainly cause most suspects to think, I think my rights apply now.
Mr. Weinstein, where should the line be drawn? Is it okay a day before, or 2 days before, or 5 days before to give the warnings and then not give them when the person's in custody?
I think you have to use the totality of the circumstances test, and the further away it is, the more that factor would weigh against or are in favor of having to give the warnings a second time, but other factors would also come into play, and it may be that for some suspects, yesterday would be fine, for others not.
What about your opposing counsel's argument that Miranda really got away from the totality of the circumstances, that was rejected in Miranda?
Well, I think what that argument confuses is voluntariness of the statement, which was the test prior to Miranda, versus voluntariness of the waiver of the Fifth Amendment, which is what Miranda is aimed at. And there are two voluntary propositions that have to be decided. The first is whether or not the person voluntarily waives the right to remain silent. And the second, independent of that, is whether or not the statement is in fact voluntary. And of course we have situations.
It's the two prongs of Miranda Goodchild hearings, right?
Right. And of course, a voluntary statement which doesn't get Miranda warnings can still be used on cross-examination if the defendant takes the stand. So that kind of underscores the fact that we're looking at two different things here. And so I don't think Miranda does reject the totality of the circumstances in respect to the waiver of the Fifth Amendment.
Only
in respect to the confession itself. Before Miranda, the test was, is the statement voluntary, without regard to whether or not the defendant was aware of the Fifth Amendment right to remain silent or any of that other sort of thing. And so the total question before the courts before Miranda, well, because of the line of cases starting with Escobedo and others, there's not
not a real bright line, but prior to all of that development of the jurisprudence, the test was, is the confession itself voluntary? If the confession itself is voluntary, that's the end of the inquiry.
And there we've always used a totality of the circumstances approach, right?
That's right. And I think, as I read the case law, the totality of the circumstances is also used to determine the waiver of the Fifth Amendment / Miranda. But there are two different inquiries. The one is, is this a valid waiver of the Fifth Amendment? And if there's no question about that, then the only question is the statement voluntary? So I think that's where that particular argument runs into trouble.
So you would say on that time issue that we talked about a couple minutes ago, that's a totality of the circumstances approach?
Yes.
In other words, the day before or 2 days before or whatever.
That's right. And for a very experienced, for instance, a suspect who's perhaps been through the confession mill three or four times, you know, the fact that he got the Miranda warnings 5 o'clock yesterday and he's given a statement at 5 o'clock today, that might be okay for someone who's or for the law professor perhaps, but for somebody who is unfamiliar with the system, maybe not. But those are the kinds of judgments we call on the circuit courts and the appellate courts to make all the time. So this wouldn't represent anything new in that regard. In regard to harm, what harm? I think there is a harm here. I think when you require the police to guess about whether or not Miranda should be given, you're creating a disincentive to give warnings. And I don't think that's particularly good for defendants. And I think that it's better to have a defendant warned, even if it's early, than not warned at all. And it seems to me the police response to a rule that Grady advances is either don't give warnings at all or try to guess when the right is, or make an arrest and worry about whether you've got sufficient probable cause later. And I'm not sure that's good either. So it seems to me that there is a societal cost here to a rule that says if you warn this suspect a half an hour too soon, the statement's out, because police are going to respond to that. And I don't think the response is particularly good for us in the overall development of the law.
Let's just suppose he's not in custody, just like in this case. He's being questioned, which may or not be interrogation, right? Under questioning is not necessarily interrogation, right?
Right.
He's not a suspect. He's given his Miranda warnings. And although he was quite friendly going down to the police station, once there and given the Miranda, he says, I don't want to talk to you, and I want a lawyer. What happens then?
That's Edwards.
That's
Edwards versus Arizona, which says at that point the police.
Even though it's not custodial, and even though it's not interrogation.
Oh, I'm sorry. If he's
same
not
case
no,
as
if,
this.
I'm sorry. I missed
not that. Not custody, not interrogation, not a suspect. It's a prophylactic Miranda warning, and he thinks about it and he says, "Well, I'm not going to answer any questions.
Well,
I want a lawyer."
Right. He doesn't have the right to appointment of a lawyer at public expense, but certainly if he's free to leave, which is the test for custody, he can go out and consult the lawyer. He can walk away. So
the police would have to recognize that.
Well, if the person wanted to leave and the police prevented it seems to me that at that point he's in custody.
Then he's in custody. Then the question is that questioning may look like interrogation.
And if they again ask him a question, well, I guess then what would happen is if a suspect attempted to leave and the police prevented it,
and that keys custody. Then the question would be, would there be a valid invocation for Edwards' purposes? Now, to get back to your original question, which I misunderstood, the law currently is that you can't invoke the Edwards bar prior to being in custody. That doesn't mean you can't invoke your right to counsel or that you can't invoke your right to remain silent. You can. But
when you're not in custody and you get the Miranda warnings too early, you can invoke your rights.
Sure. You can just say, I'm not going to answer that question. Now, the difference between pre- and post-custody is that if you're pre-custody, the police can try to persuade you to talk anyway. If you're post-custody, they can't. But certainly, as this court said in State versus Mark, a Fifth Amendment can be asserted in any proceeding, civil or criminal, formal or informal. Any question that tends to incriminate somebody, you can assert Fifth Amendment. So it's not correct that you can't assert your Fifth Amendment in a pre-custodial setting. It's just the consequences of that are somewhat different.
And you have to distinguish between asserting your Fifth Amendment right to remain silent and requesting counsel. And requesting counsel at government expense or your counsel.
That's right. You could still have counsel and have counsel present also, but you'd have to pay for it. The suspect would have to pay for it himself.
Pre-custodial, pre-interrogation.
Right.
Would it be fair to say that this individual didn't fully, or didn't act on his Miranda warnings, in part because he was pursuing a strategy of trying to finger somebody else?
It's possible that there's not a lot of detail about what Grady's statements were prior to the time that the police accused him of being the shooter. The only thing that's in the record is that the officers testify up until he was placed under arrest, he denied being involved. But it doesn't say, they never said he tried to implicate Ward. So I don't know the answer to that.
Wasn't there an exchange? Police talked to him, and he promised that as soon as he knew where Ward was, that he would call the police?
Yes. That there is.
Because Ward was a suspect in a murder.
Right. Ward was a suspect because Ward had attempted to sell the victim's car. So
he helped the police find Ward.
Yes. I think that's fair reading of the transcript. Yes.
How could he not understand that if he fingers Ward, Ward is probably going to finger him?
I don't know.
That's a good question.
It's not the first time I've seen that.
It's a credibility issue.
I'm sorry?
It's a credibility issue.
That's right. It is.
He helped the police. Maybe they'll believe him.
And I think maybe that was his approach in answering questions to begin with. But I don't know that for
Does
sure.
Does the motive make any difference here? His motive?
No. It's because it's an objective test. Just as whether or not the police actually thought he was under arrest or not doesn't matter. It's whether he was, in fact, in custody from an objective point of view.
But there was no question, is it, that he was in custody at what time? About midnight? 10:30? 10:30?
My recollection is that the questioning started at about 7:45, and he was placed under arrest around 10:30 or 10:45, something.
And they continued
two and a half hours, roughly.
Right, and then they continued questioning him.
I'm sorry?
They continued questioning him.
That's right, they did.
When did they stop that first
was around 5 o'clock in the next morning.
On the 17th. Then they booked him.
Right. And he went to a holding cell, and then they came and began the second session in the evening of the second day.
About 7:30.
And that, he was actually, he was given Miranda again the second time.
And then he gave a second statement.
Right. And referring, as far as the second statement is concerned, I think Elstead does control that.
You don't think what goes there?
Elstead does control the second statement. Because Siebert, the officer testified that he was following a strategy of get the statement first without warnings, and after you get what you want, give the warnings, and get a second statement, and then don't introduce the first statement at trial. And that's not what happened here. I mean, if in fact there is a violation in that first statement, it is inadvertent. I mean, it's because the police thought that the first warnings were effective. And that's exactly the kind of thing, it seems to me, Elstead says, well, if the second statement is warned, then the second statement's fine. And that's what we have.
To what extent do you look to the circumstances of the first statement? Let's assume the court would say the first statement is bad because we're going to take a bright line rule, or the totality of circumstances say, hey, you questioned this guy roughly 10 hours straight, gave him a warning in the first part, your circumstances changed, booked, arrested, taken away strings. So we say that the first statement's bad. What's the test to determine whether the second statement is tainted?
If there's a sufficient attenuation.
Okay. It's a taint test. Sufficient attenuation between the two.
But that would assume that the first statement was involuntary.
Oh, no, I'm assuming it's voluntary, but he was not appropriately Mirandized.
I guess it would then depend on whether or not the court characterized the lack of Miranda in the first statement as being inadvertent or not. Because if it's inadvertent, Elstead controls. If it's not inadvertent, then, and it's also not deliberate, I'm not sure whether there's a third category or not. But
I'm assuming it was inadvertent. This is not a plot.
If it's inadvertent, it seems to me Elstead stands for the proposition that an inadvertent violation of a first statement that's followed by a second statement that's fully warned is the second statement's admissible.
You don't go to attenuation.
I think you only use the attenuation test if the first statement's involuntary.
Okay.
There are no
further
questions.
Anything else?
Thank you.
Let's clarify one thing. In this case, you are not asking this court, and Mr. Cheshire is not asking this court to decide if the state met its heavy burden of proving that the defendant waived his Miranda warnings, right? That is not an issue that we need to decide.
He's never contested the fact that the statements were voluntary or that he was not aware of his right to remain silent. As I read Brady's brief, his argument is this should be a bright line rule. We don't care whether or not the defendant is actually aware of the rights or the consequences of giving up the rights. We look solely at whether or not he was in custody at the time of the warnings. I guess I could be wrong about that, but that's the way I interpret his argument. And so it wouldn't matter whether or not.
Well, are you aware of any, isn't the record consistent that he actually understood his rights?
I think that, well, with the exception of the fact that they never said, do you understand your rights, and he said yes, I think it is.
Well, there would have been other hearings, there would have been other opportunities for him to have said that.
Right.
And he never said that.
He never testified either.
But the burden is on the state, which is why I'm asking.
That's right. The burden is on the state.
Not on the defendant. So that's why I want to be clear that There is no issue here about the state failing to meet its burden to prove that the defendant waived his rights.
The only thing I can say is he's never contended that.
Okay. Thank you.
Are you familiar with the LaFave passage I gave you?
I'm sorry?
Are you familiar with the passage from the LaFave text that I read?
I hadn't actually read that, but I think I did discover a few cases that have specifically addressed this kind of situation before, which I gave to I sent a
and
letter.
And they hold what I said they held.
They hold the same as LaFave's.
Did you find any cases that were contrary?
I did not.
Okay. Mr. Cheshire?
Counsel, can you start by clarifying what your bright line rule is? As just articulated by your opposing counsel, the trigger point for your bright line rule, as he articulated it, was custodial, being in custody. When I read your brief and the way you frame the issues, I see your bright line rule to have a trigger point of arrest, which is
because in this particular case, I think arrest and custodial interrogation coincided together. I didn't make that particular distinction. But I think that what Miranda is addressing is custodial interrogation. So
do I. So I look at page 13 when you have, thus for a defendant's, and you're talking generally, statement to be admissible, Miranda rights are not required until a defendant is under arrest. That's not right.
I would put it custody, Your Honor.
Okay. other places. Grady contends that page 11 of your brief, bottom of the page. Grady contends that a bright line rule should be drawn that a defendant is not deemed to be aware of his or her Miranda rights until the defendant has received Miranda warnings after being arrested. Again,
we'll change it to placed in custody. I think that would be more consistent. Like I said, Your Honor, I use it synonymously only because of the facts in this particular case.
Okay. So your brief with regard to a bright line, well, you're talking about a bright line rule that would be obviously not just for this case, but for others.
Correct.
And you're talking now custodial interrogation consistent with Miranda as opposed to the touchstone being whether or not he was placed under arrest. Right? Were the facts in this case conducive to an interpretation that he was in custody at any time prior to his arrest?
No, I think I don't think anyone has any dispute that it was non-custodial until about 10:45 in the evening.
What were they talking about from 8:15 to 10:45?
Apparently, they wanted him to help substantiate whatever it was Mr. Ward was saying, because Mr. Grady was apparently one of the last people that had seen or knew Ward's whereabouts, and so they thought that he would be able to help them, you know, verify whatever it is that Ward was telling them.
Shortly after 10:45, or maybe at 10:45, the police indicate that Grady has implicated, Ward has implicated Grady.
Correct.
How long was it after that he caved?
Well, they continued to talk to him for about 7 hours. So, I guess I don't know. I don't think it's clear.
That's my impression, and maybe I'm wrong, that he caved almost immediately. Is that wrong?
I don't recall. I'm not sure whether we keep talking to him for 7 hours, though, if that was the case.
When we write this opinion, we should be clear, I think, to say that the defendant is not arguing that the state failed to meet its heavy burden of labor. Is that accurate?
At the trial court level, of course, he did argue that the statements were involuntary, that sort of thing. However, the trial court, I thought, made very good findings at that point that weren't appealable.
So that's not our issue.
Right.
Okay.
I didn't want you to think that it was because it was just conceded at that point.
Okay.
There are a couple of clarifications I'd like to make, if I may. My opposing counsel has talked about the totality of the circumstances, and there's plenty of case law there. He's correct in regards to whether the rights have been waived and or whether or not a statement is voluntary. I believe that what Miranda, however, was saying, that whether or not a defendant is aware of their rights after they're placed in custody, that that's not a totality of circumstances test. And that's why they wanted the warnings. That's why they say the warning should be given at the onset of a custodial interrogation. And so I believe that there's a big distinction there. I don't think we should necessarily blur the line. I don't think Miranda is saying that the awareness of a person's rights is dependent on the totality of circumstances. I think they say just the opposite. And that's why I think a bright line makes sense as far as whether or not they are aware of their rights.
So this all would have been fixed up if, after they arrested him, an arrest looks like it's custody, they gave him another warning, right?
If I'd be here today, Your Honor.
Pardon me?
I do not believe I would be here today.
Okay. Do you agree with the state that as to the second warning, that since this is not claimed to be a strategy by the police and deliberate and intentional, that the case law is that second confession is okay?
Well, no, I don't agree. I mean, I think if you look at Elstad, that quote-unquote custodial statement, I mean, that was in a woman's living room, and the officer that was being spoken to was actually talking to the defendant's mother, explaining what was going on, and the defendant made a statement to the effect that, yeah, he was at the scene. The officer he was talking to didn't even know for sure that the other officer had placed the defendant under arrest at that time. And so that was clearly an inadvertent oversight there. And I don't see where there's any inadvertent oversight as to when Grady was placed in custody here.
Well, according to the Elstad case, it's generally viewed that he was not in custody, right? In Elstad, he was not in custody.
No, he was in custody.
Held, he responded to unwarned yet non-coercive questioning in his own living room before being taken to the police. So you're saying he was in custody, but it wasn't coercive.
That was deemed a custodial setting in the living room.
And it wasn't coercive.
Right.
And so he gave, he was given the Miranda warnings in Elstead?
After he was taken down to the police station, mm-hmm. Then he was given his warnings and he gave a detailed statement.
But his first statement was okay?
Or at least it didn't affect the second statement.
Okay.
Addressing the Elstad analysis, does your client concede or does he contest that as to the second prong of your argument, the fruit of the poisonous tree for the second interview, the Mirandized interview, do you take the position that your client concedes or contests that the omission that would be present under the bright line test that you urge upon us, would that, in your client's estimation, would that have been inadvertent or would that have been purposeful?
Well, I think it's essentially purposeful. I mean, it's real clear that the police knew whether he was in custody and whether or not custodial interrogation was started up, and they're under an obligation to give him his Miranda rights at the onset of that.
Even though this officer testified that he knew he didn't have a legal duty to provide
provide the Miranda warnings in the non-custodial situation, but it was his customer, it was his common practice to do so.
I guess I don't see how that has really had any relevance, to tell you the truth.
Would it have relevance if it had occurred 5 minutes prior? Because with this bright line rule, we're going to have to apply it to other cases.
And that's why my answer is, yeah, no, I don't think it would have relevance then. I don't think it should have. I don't think you have a bright line rule. I'm sorry.
Even as to the LSTAT, I'm trying to give you an opportunity, just like the Chief Justice was, even though the red light's been on for some time. It is the second prong of your argument, and I want to be clear that you understand my question runs to the fruit of the poisonous tree, not to the bright line rule itself. That was the context of my question.
And I guess my quick response is that my understanding is fruit of the poisonous tree doesn't apply to statements and subsequent statements. And very briefly, I think Seibert says, you know, the threshold question is, at what point, perhaps, is a defendant able to make a clear choice? And also, I think that in Westover, they're saying that had the FBI taken the person to another place at another time and gave him his rights and interviewed him, then that probably would have been okay.
So the second statement here is okay?
No. I think that Seibert's controlling. I'm just saying that I think that the holdings in those cases, you know, address that it is possible for a subsequent statement to be admissible.
Your position is Elstead doesn't apply here, is that right?
Correct.
And that the Siebert case applies?
Yes.
Okay. And your position is if Elstead did apply, then the fact that there was a second Miranda warning prior to the second confession, that's good enough. The Elstead.
I still think that the Seibert, whether or not he...
I understand.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I appreciate the additional time, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cheshire, and thank you, Mr. Weinstein, for yet another Miranda warning. What was the date of Miranda? 64. 2008. 44 years, is it? That we've been debating Miranda. 66. Now, that will now be 30,001. That concludes our hearing in 07AP672CR State versus Grady. The court will be in recess for a few moments so students may leave and other students may come in.